I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been a weekend of shifting alignment in the Middle East. The Palestinian prime minister, who had become Washington's favored navigator of the roadmap to peace, has resigned. Mahmoud Abbas says he was not able to win the backing of other Palestinian leaders. At the same time, the Israeli government has decided to ratchet up its targeted killing of Hamas leaders. Over the weekend, the Israeli military tried and failed to kill the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Israel's Prime Minister Sharon is quoted as saying that all Hamas leaders are dead men. And now today, the man who may well become the next Palestinian prime minister has entered the arena with a new call for Western guarantees of assistance, for the greater involvement of Americans and Europeans as a condition of his taking on the new role. Connection listeners, how do you think the weekend developments in the Middle East will impact America's commitment to forging a peace there? President Bush talked last night of the money and the time needed to deal with Iraq. Does that mean that the West Bank and Gaza will simply have to wait? Are you interpreting the weekend's news as a detour or the destruction of the roadmap? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll talk with a number of players today. We're going to start in Ramallah with the New York Times correspondent, James Bennett. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me, what's...
Actually, I have to tell you I'm no longer in Ramallah. I'm back in Jerusalem.
Oh, okay. Thanks for clarifying that. You were expecting news in Ramallah that's not going to happen?
Well, no. The appointed, nominated Prime Minister, Abu Allah, is expected to meet fairly shortly with Yasser Arafat, and we don't know yet what's going to come out of that discussion.
James, what's changed here, if in fact Ahmed Krea replaces Mahmoud Abbas as Palestinian prime minister? What's going to be different?
Well, the big change, I guess, is that we've had one guy try and fail, and so that now there's kind of an example of what to do or what not to do. Everybody involved in this, all the parties are saying that they're going to learn from the mistakes that were made with and by Mahmoud Abbas. The problem is that nobody can agree on precisely what those mistakes are. Everybody's got very different versions.
And isn't it also true that Yasser Arafat is never really going to release to anyone else the degree of control he currently holds over the Palestinian security apparatus?
Well, it seems pretty unlikely. He hasn't really been given an incentive to do that. Part of the problem with the dynamic that's been set up here is that success on the part of whoever is prime minister means failure from Yasser Arafat's perspective. It means that he is exiting from the stage, that he would not receive credit for any progress that was made toward peace. It would all accrue to the prime minister. So in this sense, he's given an incentive here either to sit on his hands or to actively work against the person who's put in the job. This new nominated prime minister is the current speaker of the Palestinian parliament, and he is a far more experienced politician than Abbas. It is likely to work better, probably, with Yasser Arafat. The problem is that from the American-Israeli perspective, the closer he works with Yasser Arafat, the more they dislike what he's up to.
So it is in many ways just about as impossible a task as the one that Mahmoud Abbas faced.
Well, it's essentially the same one, except, again, the Israelis say this time around they're going to absolutely insist that whoever takes this job immediately take action against groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad to collect their weapons, break them apart, to essentially do what Israel now says it is doing in the West Bank and Gaza. So in a sense, the pressure on this new prime minister, at least from Israel, might be even greater at the outset than it was on Abbas.
And as you noted in your reporting, Israel continued that campaign with some vigor over the weekend. This attack on the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, is that a change in any way, a toughening up of Israeli policy, James?
Well, Israel says it was attacking a conclave of Hamas leaders, that it wasn't just Sheikh Yassin, but that he was meeting with several guys, including a couple of people that are known, kind of one in particular known master bomb maker. Yassin has denied that they were present. But yes, it's a significant escalation in the Israeli attack on Hamas. They really started this campaign about 3 weeks ago after a suicide bombing in Jerusalem killed 22 people. And the first guy they went after was a man named Ismail Abu Shanab, who was a declared political leader of Hamas. He insisted he did not have any involvement in any kind of planning of terrorist actions, but was an ideologue from the group, was seen actually as a pragmatic leader. But Israel says it no longer recognizes any distinction between so-called political and so-called military leaders, that all these Hamas men are, as Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said over the weekend, now, quote-unquote, marched for death.
And so do you make any linkage, James, between the Israeli military's targeting of Hamas leaders, including Sheikh Yassin, and the shuffling of prime ministers that was taking place in Ramallah over the weekend?
Well, in the sense that it was the final evidence, or the clearest evidence, that the peace process had almost completely fallen apart. Israel said it had to take that action because it had given up on the notion that Prime Minister Abbas was going to take any serious measures against Hamas. Abbas said, in fact, he was about to do so, but that the Israeli campaign interfered with him and made it politically impossible for him to do so. But Israel, after that bus bombing on August 19th, not only started his campaign against Hamas, but also froze all political dialogue with the governing Palestinian Authority and with Abbas. The only thing that Abbas had going for him with the Palestinian public, really, was his claim to be making some progress towards peace, making some kind of advances that might improve the daily lives of Palestinians. That evaporated at that point, and his collapse followed fairly swiftly afterward.
James, if you can just stay with us a few minutes, I'd like to bring in Ambassador Richard Murphy. He was the American ambassador to Syria and Saudi Arabia in the 70s during the Reagan administration. He was Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs. He's now Senior Fellow for the Middle East at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's joining us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Ambassador Murphy, welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you so much.
How do you see the implications of the shuffle of the two Palestinian prime ministers? Any dramatic change to replace one with another?
I hope so, but I'm starting out pessimistic on this because, as James Bennett said, it's a question from Arafat's side of incentives. I mean, Ahmed Korey has worked with Arafat as long, as closely as Mahmoud Abbas. And as a Palestinian observed about Mahmoud Abbas, he was Arafat's number two. He still is Arafat's number two. That was before the resignation. And Korey, as Speaker of the Parliament, has been a very close collaborator. Yes, he's an experienced politician. He may be more at ease in diplomacy than Mahmoud Abbas. But the grinding realities of the positions that he's contemplating getting into haven't changed. And the question of incentives for Yasser Arafat is a key one. We denied him the incentive of leadership over a year ago, that is the United States, in saying we would not deal with him and demanded a prime minister be appointed. And that's the personal side of it. He's obviously resented that. Now there's the more political side, the issue side. What is Israel going to be doing that will help Ahmed Korey take over?
And where does this leave the United States then? I mean, is it fair for the White House to say at this point, look, there is chaos at the top level of the Palestinian Authority. Israel is not backing off in its attacks on the Hamas leaders. It's clear that no one there is really pursuing peace, so why should we?
Well, it's fair, and I think you're referring to a statement by Condoleezza Rice over the weekend that the problem was that the Palestinian leadership was hamstrung by internal bickering. But, you know, one thing the Israeli leadership is not hamstrung by is its position on settlements. It has not moved decisively, as called for under the roadmap, to close down those outposts that were established back in 2001. So we talk about, I'm sure that Rice didn't mean to say all of responsibilities on the Palestinian side, but that's the way she got quoted back here in the States.
And is Washington seen, James Bennett, back to you, is Washington seen to be dragging its feet here by not forcing both Israel and the Palestinians to try and abide by at least the sort of basic first steps of the roadmap.
It's almost taken as axiomatic on both sides here now that Washington is very distracted by what's happening in Iraq and by the upcoming presidential campaign. It hasn't been lost on either of the parties here, I think, that the Bush administration has not dispatched a high-level envoy here since the peace process began to collapse almost 3 weeks ago. Previously, it really took visits by Secretary of State Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice to push the process even very small steps forward. And there's been no sign that they're going to do that again. President Bush did not deal with specifically with what's happened here in his speech last night. So it seemed to be sliding down the list of Bush administration priorities.
And is it seen by people there, James, as simply a lack of interest or more practically a lack of opportunities, that there's not much to do right now?
Well, both, I guess. I mean, the Palestinians are increasingly frustrated with Washington. They feel that the policy is biased in favor of Israel, that, as the ambassador said, the Washington keeps urging Palestinian side to take action against terrorism and against groups like Hamas, but is not putting the same pressure on the Israelis to take its mandated steps under the roadmap, which included halting all expansion of settlements and dismantling the outposts that the ambassador referred to. So they're feeling like it wasn't the roadmap wasn't fairly enforced by Washington on both sides here.
Ambassador Murphy, pick up on one of the things that James was mentioning. That is that the president makes a speech to the nation last night all about American involvement in the Middle East and no mention of Israel or the Palestinians at all. An indicator to you that the White House is disengaging?
Not yet. I'm not. I hope not. The White House has been reminded that if it doesn't stay committed to the roadmap, it's going to be a victory for Hamas, for Islamic Jihad, for the militants, the so-called Arafat militants, and it's abandoning that significant part of the war on terror. So he didn't mention it. The American audience was certainly expecting a statement that would focus on Iraq, and it did so. It brought in Afghanistan, but did not discuss the Arab-Israeli or Israeli-Palestinian talks. The president is going to be constrained in terms of walking away by the fact that this remains a key area in which he has staked his prestige to combat terrorism.
James Bennett, quick last one to you. What's next? Is Ahmed Krea certain to be confirmed as Palestinian prime minister?
Well, he's certainly be confirmed if he accepts the post, and I think he is likely to accept the post. There's going to be a lot of internal Palestinian political pressure on him to do it, or some pressure from Washington and European diplomats as well to do it. So I think it's likely that he will take the job. And in a certain sense, we'll be back to square one and beginning this process over again, with the model of Mahmoud Abbas, now somewhat of a tragic figure in this whole process, because he was regarded basically on all sides as a sincere man who was trying to do his best in the job.
James, I'm sorry I have to interrupt you there. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us. James Bennett of the New York Times. We're back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we are talking this hour about the weekend's developments in the Middle East, what they tell us about prospects for the roadmap for peace. My guest, Ambassador Richard Murphy, he's now the Senior Fellow for the Middle East at the Council on Foreign Relations, was ambassador in both Syria and Saudi Arabia in the 1970s, and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs. Connection listeners, how do you look at the weekend developments in the Middle East? What will the impact be on America's efforts or commitment to forging a peace there? Mahmoud Abbas, Palestinian Prime Minister, goes ahead with his plans to resign, and Ahmed Krea is marked as the person who is coming in to replace him. They are both senior members of the Palestinian Authority, so we're asking what's changed there and also taking a look at Israel's ratcheting up of its plans to target Hamas leaders in Gaza. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Rassan Al-Khatib. He is Minister of Labor for the Palestinian Authority, and he's joining us from the West Bank in Ramallah. Rassan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me, in your view, whether or not there's anything substantially different replacing one Palestinian prime minister with another, if they're both so much a part of the Palestinian Authority and both so close to Yasser Arafat.
Exactly for the reasons you mentioned, I don't think that this is going to be a significant change, at least as far as the fundamental aspects of the conflict, i.e. the political aspects, are concerned. Probably this replacement might ease the internal tension a little bit between the prime minister position and the president, because the new candidate for the prime ministry is not going to be perceived by the president as any kind of a threat to his position. And I think that his style and approach might allow him to be more successful in establishing more productive working relations with the president than the previous prime minister. But as you said, on the political level, there is no significant differences between the political thinking. I mean, all of them belong to the same political school of thought in Palestinian politics.
You talk about a more productive working relationship with President Arafat. Now, you know better than I do that the responsibility put on the Palestinian Authority under the Roadmap for Peace is to try and disarm and restrain the militants. Do you think that Mr. Krea, if he becomes prime minister, will be any more successful at that than Mahmoud Abbas was?
It depends. I mean, if the new prime minister is going to be put in the same situations, then he will not be more successful. Any prime minister will be able to proceed with fulfilling the Palestinian obligations to the roadmap as much as the other side is fulfilling their obligations to the roadmap. And this is not an issue of tit for tat. It's an objective matter. The Palestinian leadership will be empowered and more capable of doing what it needs to do when it makes political achievements. And these political achievements are exactly the kind of things that Israel has to do in terms of fulfilling their obligations to the roadmap. So, for example, if Israel will be dismantling outpost settlements and stopping expansion of settlement, then this will empower the Palestinian leadership, prime minister, and enable him to gain public support in his attempts to try to maintain the success of the roadmap, including fulfilling the Palestinian obligations, including disarming opposition groups, etc.
But Mr. Al-Khatib, what you're describing to me is exactly tit for tat, that no one on the Palestinian side has to do anything until the Israelis start to move, and the Israelis saying exactly the same thing, and it's the same sort of deadly circle that that region has seen for weeks or for 4 months now.
Except that this particular proposal, and this is, I mean, the roadmap, and this is its main strength, is that it doesn't expect one party to start in order that the other party will do the same. This roadmap is about simultaneous fulfillment of each side to their obligations to the roadmap, which will allow the Israeli average person to see actual improvement in the security situation, and in the same time, it will allow a Palestinian average person to see progress on the issues of his concern, like the settlement expansion and the appropriation of the Palestinian land, etc.
It seems to me, though, that until that happens, most Palestinians are put in a position of having to choose, of having to decide whether or not they want to support the crowds outside Sheikh Yassin's home, the people who are calling for a continued war with Israel, and people who would be more inclined towards following the Palestinian Authority on the roadmap for peace, that people are becoming more divided, one or the other.
That's right. That's unfortunate. But let us also take into consideration some of the significant factors that are also pushing for this polarization you mentioned. The increase in the poverty and the desperation of the Palestinian people, the increase in the humiliation the Palestinian people are living, the increase in the Israeli assassination policy of Palestinians are playing to the hand of the extremists in the Palestinian side. Unfortunately, extremists in the two sides have been reinforcing each other. The militant groups in Palestine are benefiting from the kind of policies and practices Israel is doing. And the opposition camp in Israel, which happened to be the government in Israel, actually, is also benefiting from the extreme actions and violence from the Palestinian militant groups. That's why somebody from outside has to break this process of reinforcing each other by opposition groups in the two sides, and have to try to break this vicious circle of violence. And we assumed that the American government is supposed to be playing more active role, again, as fulfillments of its obligations to the roadmap, because the roadmap suggested that the quartet, and later the American government took this responsibility, should play the role of monitoring the implementation of the roadmap, which the United States did not do.
Let me stop you there if I can, because I would like to turn to Ambassador Murphy on this point precisely, whether or not the United States has to date exercised the responsibility that it might have in forcing not just the Palestinians to try and restrain their militants, but in encouraging or forcing the Israeli government to curtail the settlement activity. Is it fair to say that Washington's not done that?
Well, you know, as an outsider to the administration, I have no idea about the tone of the exchanges between the White House, the State Department, and the Prime Minister's office in Israel. It's been more public as far as U.S. pressure on the Palestinians, more publicly expressed that you've got to root out those militants, you've got to move against them publicly, frontally. It doesn't seem... But as I repeat, as an outsider, it's hard to evaluate. It doesn't seem that the same type of direct pressure has been applied to the leadership in Israel concerning the settlements, the expansion of settlements, and the elimination of the outposts. But that's the way it appears to me.
Let's turn to Ofer Shelach now. He is a journalist, news analyst with the Israeli Daily Newspaper, Yediot Aranot, joining us from his home in Rehavot, south of Tel Aviv. Ofer, you're listening in, and I'd like you to join us, if you would, just on the point that Ambassador Murphy was addressing. That is, whether or not Washington is or has seemed to be even-handed here.
Well, I'm not in no better position than Ambassador Murphy to judge what really has been said to the Israeli government. But from our vantage point here in Israel, it definitely does not seem as though the Israeli government is under any kind of pressure from Washington. There seem to be some disagreements with the question of Arafat's expulsion from Ramallah or whatever. But basically, it seems to us that basically Israel is given a free hand by the United States. Some of the activities that the United States has expressed opposition to, like the assassinations, it was barely a slap on the wrist. It seems as though the government of Israel feels no pressure. And let me put it this way. I think Prime Minister Sharon, one of his major considerations is the way the United States feels about things, and if he does act, that implies better than any other sign that he is under no pressure.
Ofer, the same question that I was asking Khorasan about what's happening in that ongoing battle in your region. Now, do you, or is it seen by people on the Israeli side, as just a war between Hamas and Israel, with the Palestinian Authority becoming somewhat irrelevant?
Yes, exactly that. I think both of you basically indicated the kind of vicious circle that we are in that the level of mistrust on both sides is such that there is a war being waged by Israel against Hamas, mainly Hamas and other terrorist groups. And what Israel clearly says is this: we will give any Palestinian government a limited amount of time to act in a way that most people in Israel know and believe they cannot act. And actually, even Mahmoud Abbas, when he assumed power, but assumed this position, said that he was not going to act the way Israel wanted him to. So actually, he was in no way going to fulfill what Israel wanted him to do, and Israel gave him, you know, several days to do that, and then started acting on its own. So basically, what we are seeing is what you indicated. We're seeing a war between the Israeli army and Hamas and Islamic Jihad on the other side, with the Palestinian Authority, such as it exists. Being caught in the middle, and the situation deteriorating quite rapidly into what I see as almost inevitably Israel moving into the Gaza Strip and actually doing in the Gaza Strip what it did last year in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank.
I want to, all of us, if we can, just pause for a minute and listen to what it was that Ahmed Kreia said a little bit earlier today, when he was outlining the conditions that he felt were required for him to do his job well.
I want to see what kind of support I will receive to change the situation on the ground for the favor of the Palestinian people. That's very important. Without it, I'm not going to accept for a new failure. I don't want to fail. And therefore, I want to see what kind of change on the ground the Israeli will give, what kind of support from the United States in this regard. I want to see that the Israeli will change the way of dealing with the President Arafat.
I want to turn, if I can, to Hassan Al-Khatib. He's labor minister in the Palestinian government at present. And if I listen between the lines of what Mr. Kreia is saying, what I'm hearing is that the authority in the Palestinian Authority would have to come from Washington, from the European countries, rather than from Palestinians themselves.
In the current situations, in order for the Palestinian Authority to maintain its authority, we need to ensure progress in the peace process towards ending the Israeli reoccupation, which will allow the re-emerging of the real power and authority of the Palestinian Authority. But what Kreia said is extremely significant, and this reminds me of what Abbas was saying recently, and I consider myself close to Prime Minister Abbas, and I have been seeing him almost on a daily basis. He was disappointed, actually, in the fact that the United States was expressing, relatively speaking, acceptable remarks on verbal level vis-a-vis the situations here. But in practical level, they did not do enough in order to bring these verbal commitments into action. For example, President Bush, even on that level, referred several times to the need that Israel should stop building this wall, because it's harmful even to his vision. It is creating a reality that is not conducive to the Bush's vision, which is the two states. President Bush referred publicly also to the need to stop settlement expansion. But the American government did not do anything to bring Israel into compliance with these actions, which left Mahmoud Abbas in a terrible situation, as the previous speaker said, caught between the two sides.
And Ofer Shalak, it also seemed to have left Israel's Prime Minister Sharon with the freedom to do and continue to do whatever he wants.
That's exactly the case. That's why I think it's important for Korea to make sure that that each side should be fulfilling their obligations. I mean, there are obligations on the international community. The Quartet is the party which came up with this roadmap, and the roadmap, the text of the roadmap, put specific obligations on the Quartet, and later it was transferred to the American government to have a certain role in making efforts to monitor and to work on delivering.
Rassan Al-Khatib, I want to hear Ofer Shelakh on this very point, whether or not Sharon has carte blanche under the current situation.
I don't know if you're 100% carte blanche, and that requires me to answer a different question, which we Israelis find it very hard to answer, which is, what does Sharon exactly want? And what are his real intentions, except for, you know, playing for time, enjoying the kind of support that he has from the United States, and basically blaming it on the other side. And that's a question that, you know, we have been asking ourselves for the past 2.5 years, and we haven't got the exact answer to. You have to realize that Mr. Sharon is under extreme political pressure in Israel itself, regardless of the security situation. And in fact, the security situation is right now maybe the I wouldn't say the last thread, but one of the thickest threads holding him on to power. And in that respect, I don't see any change in Mr. Sharon's policy unless obliged to do so. And obliged to do so definitely means the Americans are making him change. And I don't see that happening, if you allow me to analyze the American standpoint as far as we see it from Israel. We don't see any signs of this. So we are caught in this vicious cycle, and it's unfortunately, what we see here in Israel, not much hope of any change whatsoever.
All right, and Connection listeners, that's where we will put the question to you when we come back after the break, whether or not you see the United States as putting any real pressure on either side in the conflict here. Ofer Shelakh, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ofer is a journalist and news analyst with the Israeli daily newspaper Yediot Aharonot, and Hassan Al-Khatib, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Hassan is the Palestinian Minister of Labor. Connection listeners, Ambassador Murphy remains with us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. A chance to hear from you when we come back. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Lots of news from the Mideast this weekend. A replacement of Palestinian Prime Minister, sort of a ratcheting up of the Israeli campaign to target Hamas leaders. Do we look at these stories as a detour or a dead end of the roadmap? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's start in Ashland, Massachusetts, and Imran's on the phone. Hi, Imran.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to make, I guess, maybe the general observation of the whole process of how we went about imposing a new leadership on the Palestinians. And
the we being the United States here?
The United States and Israel. I think that, you know, for better or for worse, Yasser Arafat was elected by the Palestinians to represent them. And the idea that because we don't like somebody as their leader, and that we try to, in Sharon's words, make them irrelevant, doesn't really do anybody any good, I guess, in the long run. Because if you try to handpick somebody to represent you without the grassroots support of the people, then I think it almost becomes a recipe for failure, which is, I think, what happened with Abu Mazen. I guess when I heard about it, I wasn't surprised.
Let me ask you a question, though, Imran. If Mahmoud Abbas carried with him the stigma of being the favorite choice of both Israel and Washington, and that was in large part his undoing, now we have Ahmed Krea, who is appointed not necessarily with as much encouragement from outside, but at least initially by Arafat himself. Does that mean that he'll have any more credibility?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I guess implicit would be that if the Palestinians voted for Arafat, and now Arafat picks somebody as the prime minister, then maybe there's the implicit assumption that the people are behind that choice as well. And the real issue, I think, is whether Israel is willing to accept this new person as a person to represent the Palestinians. And I think really that's where all the power is being brokered is by Sharon and his government.
Ambassador Murphy, is it any easier for all sides here to deal with a Palestinian prime minister if he doesn't have that sort of embarrassing stamp of approval on his back from Washington and from the Israeli government?
Well, the Israelis have made it plain very publicly they're not going to countenance a situation where control of the leadership of the Palestinians reverts in any way back to Arafat or someone who does his bidding. Mm-hmm. So they're, in effect, calling on the new man, if he accepts this job, to disavow Arafat and to work directly against him. Now, when we said that there had to be a prime minister and that we wouldn't deal with Arafat, the unfortunate result was that we strengthened Arafat and silenced the critics of his leadership among the Palestinians. They would not buy the appearance of an American-imposed leader. He remained an icon, and he shined up his image thanks to his isolation in Ramallah by the Israelis and the direct opposition of our administration.
So what should the administration do? Just keep its lip buttoned on this one?
Well, that wouldn't hurt. All that the Palestinians can take some, I suppose, comfort in is that Powell did make a point of saying he did not support, in fact, that we oppose the expulsion of Arafat from Ramallah, which has become an increasing demand on the part of Sharon's supporters. I mean, Arafat's name is jet black among Israelis as a sponsor of terrorist action, as a man who had repeatedly failed to move towards peace, etc. So that position, don't expel Arafat, is worth something. What I haven't seen is anything of the dimensions that the president's father launched back in 1991 as he was trying to get the Arabs and Israelis to the Madrid summit by withholding the $10 billion of housing guarantees unless then Prime Minister Sharon moved against settlements or did not support the continuation of settlements.
It's true, though, that the administration tends to put out its position in small and less sort of table thumping manners as the one that you've just described. For example, we had Secretary of State Colin Powell giving the latest perspective of the administration and doing it, as is so often done, in small clips on the Sunday morning television talk shows. Let's listen to Secretary of State Colin Powell.
The Palestinian Legislative Council and Mr. Arafat and other authorities within the Palestinian community did not give Mr. Abbas the resources that he needed in order to go after Hamas. We have to change that.
Ambassador Murphy, when he says we have to change that, it's a real fork in the road, because to give the new prime minister more resources is in many ways to attach him even more closely to the Washington perspective here.
Well, we need to find a way to, frankly, move Israel to empower the new prime minister to do what Hassan al-Khatib and...
Ambassador Murphy, I think we've just lost our connection with New York. We'll get that up as quickly as we possibly can. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Baton Rouge, Louisiana now, Edward's been waiting on the phone. Hi, Edward.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking?
Well, I just see this as really three problems here. The first problem is what we would call Yasser Arafat, who, in my view, doesn't fully comprehend the necessary things to make a state, the necessary criteria for statehood. In particular, the idea that a government of any state has to have a complete monopoly on violence. And I'm going back several years. He really hasn't understood that point, whereas the Israelis, when they formed their state in 1948, immediately, David Ben-Gurion had a confrontation and took control of the Irgun and Stern gangs, who wanted to kind of branch off with their own violence. And, you know, under statehood, that's not possible. So that's kind of problem number one.
Although he's been able to exploit that, though, hasn't he, Edward, by saying, hey, those aren't my people. I don't control the suicide bombers, but try and reap whatever political or terror advantage that he can from that.
Well, early on in this armed intifada, in the second intifada, he, I think, deep in his mind thought that the stone throwers, the violence that was going on in the streets, that he could sort of leverage that later on into more concessions. You know, it may increase the bargaining power of Palestinians later on, but it's not conducive to the formation of a country, of a state. He must demonstrate to the world, as Auguste Comte said 300 years ago, that, you know, a country, a government, has to have complete control over violence. You and I can disagree, but we can't beat each other up over it. The second problem, I would say, and this is a big problem, is George Bush, who's incapable of placing demands, the necessary demands on Israel to move this process forward. Who can forget?
Incapable or unwilling, Edward?
I believe a little bit of both, but who can forget the time when Ariel Sharon reoccupied the West Bank after the bombing, after one of the bombings, and George Bush went on television and stared into the camera and said, in effect, to Ariel Sharon, pull back. When I mean move back, I mean move back now. And he wagged his finger at the camera. And when Ariel Sharon didn't pull back, what did George Bush do but curl his withered finger back into his palm and went away? That was the most pathetic compromise of presidential authority I've ever seen. We are just not simply placing the necessary demands on the Israelis. And then, of course, the third, and I think the worst problem of all in all of this, is Ariel Sharon, who is definitely unwilling, not incapable, but unwilling to move this process forward because he is ideologically predisposed to keeping the West Bank permanently and creating three separate cantons in the West Bank, one to the north in Nablus, one in the middle near Ramallah in Jerusalem, and one in the south in Hebron. And he's going to build a wall, an apartheid wall around those three areas. And come hell or high water, he's going to keep that West Bank.
Ambassador Murphy, is it incumbent on whoever is president of the United States to demonstrate the same degree of indignancy or anger or control over both sides in that particular conflict?
Ideally, it is to, if you want to play the role of peacemaker in the Middle East, you got to be ready to put pressure on both parties, because both need that pressure, both need incentives, both need empowerment, although I must say I agreed with one of your earlier correspondents from the Middle East that Sharon's hold on power is the security card, that he can bring security to Israel, and so let him do what he needs to do. And I'm afraid the Israelis are again trying to do something they tried in Lebanon in the 80s and against the Palestinian Authority, trying to kill off the leadership with the idea that this is going to succeed, that they were trying to kill an idea by killing individuals. And it's not worked then. I don't think it's going to work now against Hamas.
And if the current president of the United States is, as he appears to be, so distracted with the troops and the complications of Iraq, is there any power or force or authority, and I don't mean that in a military way, but more persuasive authority in Europe, any organization that can step in and play the peacemaker role that the White House appears disinclined to play right now?
I don't believe so, and I don't believe it's either in Europe, the European Union, or in the person of the Secretary General of the UN, or in Russia, the other member of the quartet. I think it really is in Washington that the role devolves to Washington, and it is a plan. The roadmap was a plan that the president supported, endorsed, and in a sense took over. Now the question is, while Europe can do something in terms of influencing Israel, it is, after all, the European Union is the number one trading party with Israel, but it is distrusted. It is considered seriously tilted towards the Palestinians and by the Israelis. So it doesn't have the audience that Washington has. And I think what I was trying to say earlier was that President Bush has to find a way to persuade Sharon to empower Ahmed Kurey, the new or the designated prime minister. And that requires some difficult decisions from Sharon, but not job-threatening or life-threatening consequences for Sharon.
Well, they could well be job-threatening if he depends on that right-wing side of his coalition to remain in power, to give Kurey that kind of weight or strength or bargaining position might very well weaken Sharon's standing, mightn't it?
He has empowerment from the Israeli center as well as the right wing. He is seen as a leader who can one of these days bring security to Israel.
Tell me in your mind, Ambassador, whether or not we've sort of reached a stage where a conversation about the roadmap to peace is an old conversation, whether or not something needs to be reestablished, reasserted. We listened to earlier correspondents in the program talk about the fact that Washington hasn't sent an envoy to the Middle East in some considerable time. Does a new effort have to be made?
It's going to be, all I can say is it's going to be a very hard thing for Washington to do. Iraq is a major preoccupation, and Washington appears to be resigned to expressing support for the roadmap with no new initiative in mind. It's going to be tough to energize the administration. There's going to be a lot of advice coming from the domestic political advisors, I believe, to the president, saying, hey, you don't need a confrontation with any element as you move further into your own presidential campaign. What is remarkable it is that he moved so far ever since Aqaba, the meeting in Aqaba on June 4th, when he got Sharon and Abu Abbas together to launch the roadmap.
But to have taken that step and then not remain engaged, is there a price to be paid for that?
I don't think it's going to be a significant price with the American electorate. It's certainly going to be a price to be paid in terms of helping to bring stability, any sense of security to Israelis or Palestinians out in the region, but it won't be a price domestically.
Ambassador Murphy, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
Ambassador Richard Murphy, Senior Fellow for the Middle East at the Council on Foreign Relations. Earlier in the program, we talked with Rassan Al-Khatib, the Palestinian Minister of Labor, Ofer Shalah, a journalist with the Israeli daily newspaper Yediot Aharonot, and James Bennett, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.